Welcome to A Lust for Life's new parenting podcast series. I'm your host, Kira O'Connor Walsh. A Lust for Life is a mental health charity on a mission to educate and empower the children and young people of Ireland through early prevention mental health programs, content and advocacy. And we also want to support the adults in our children and young people's lives, parents, teachers, guardians and friends, by giving you the tools that you need to be that one good adult in a child's life. And that is what this podcast is all about. So join us as we explore the joys and challenges and complexities of parenthood through compassionate conversations, interviews and real-life parenting stories. We're here to provide you with practical tips, support and resources to help you parent with a little more ease and to nurture both your child's and your own mental health. Jen, thank you so much for coming on to the Lust for Life Parenting Podcast. We're so happy to speak to you. Jen is a researcher, academic, podcast host of the incredibly successful Your Parenting Mojo podcast. She's a parenting coach and author of Parenting Beyond Power, How to Use Connection and Collaboration to Transform Your Family and the World. And at A Lust for Life, we are really passionate about changing the discourse around mental health. And our founder, Niall Breslin, likes to say equality is the best form of therapy. And that's something that we really hold dear. And we really do try and challenge the notion that mental health is a you problem. It's a we problem. And the systems and, you know, the systems of power that we live within are a major cause of a lot of mental health crises. And we really hold that central to our analysis. And we really reject the individualist analysis of mental health. So, but I've never seen anything like that applied to the framework of parenting. And it was almost like a blind spot for me because I was like, of course, like mental health, we're expected to parent in this atomized, individualized way. And yet your work has really shown me, you know, that there are these bigger forces at play. And of course, they impact our family life and that we can change and challenge them through our parenting too. So maybe we'll start with the podcast, if that's okay, because that's how I found you. And it is my most loved parenting podcast and most shared with other people. And it's the thing that when people are stressed out about something, I'm like, have you listened to this? You need to listen to this. So I'm evangelical about it. So talk to me about what inspired you to start it and what did you hope to achieve with the podcast? And why do you think it's been so successful?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me, first of all. I mean, what an awesome introduction. And gosh, right, our work is so well intertwined. So it's really a great honor to be here with you. And yeah, I started the podcast, it was probably 7.5 years ago now. My daughter was about 2. And I never actually wanted to be a parent, right? Like I never had the desire to have children. I never even really liked children. And I did get pregnant by choice. It wasn't an accident, but you know, I spent weeks and weeks and weeks drafting my birth plan. I mean, this thing went through multiple iterations. And then I just figured, you know, with the rest of it, we'll figure out when she gets here. And the first year is going to be hard because she won't be able to talk. But after that, we can have a conversation and then it'll be fine, right? What more do I need to know?
So easy after that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, it was, I didn't know what I didn't know, obviously. And as soon as I found out there was, I actually have no idea what I'm doing. I didn't know at the time also that I'm autistic and what autistic people do is go and learn about stuff. So I was like, you know, I think I should get a master's in psychology focused on child development and make sure I'm doing this right. And oh, maybe I should share what I'm learning with other people because it's kind of silly to just do this by myself. And then I got another master's in education because I wanted to know more about that part. And yeah, so it turned out that I wasn't the only one who was sort of hungry for research on parenting and child development. Because most of the what's out there is, you know, a writer will read a single study that's just released. Maybe there's a press release about it. And it will say, you know, growth mindset is a good thing, for example. And the writer will say, okay, what are 15 ways we can get growth mindset and encourage that in our children? And I was like, wait, how do we even know that growth mindset is a thing we should be paying attention to? Does this study that just came out confirm the previous 30 years of research on this topic or refute it or what, right? Like I never got that context. And so I started the podcast because I wanted a resource to help me find that context, and I couldn't find it anywhere. And then over time, what I realized is, as I dug more into the social systems that are affecting all of us, that we're going to talk probably a fair bit more about, that impact our mental health so much, I saw that, well, the researchers are swimming in all of that same toxic soup that the rest of us are. And so when the researchers are doing research to say, yeah, your kid's going to be more successful if you do, you know, if parents do these things, what they're actually saying is, the researchers are saying, your child would be more successful in this toxic cultural soup if you do these things. And I'm like, wait, but we don't want to swim in a toxic cultural soup. Should we actually do those things, or should we try something different? And so I've been increasingly critical of the research over the years, as I try to, you know, within my family and within the families that I support, help us move toward, I mean, a culture, a society where everyone belongs, basically, where everyone gets to live the fullest version of themselves, rather than the, you know, the sort of stuffing down of our needs and all of our shame and all of our hurt that tends to lead to the kind of mental health issues that I know are really important to you.
And you speak a lot on the podcast about, it's sometimes called respectful parenting, gentle parenting. And I think we are living in an era where so many of us want to do things differently than how we were reared, as we say in Ireland, how we were raised. But yeah, I think most of my friends, if I ask them, are you parenting in the same way as your parents parented you? They would say, absolutely not. I am really trying to do things differently. And many of us want a different kind of a life for our children. And I think respectful parenting, gentle parenting seems to be a really popular philosophy approach. Can you tell us a little bit about that as an approach?
Yeah. I mean, firstly, I guess to put it in context, you know, why are so many of us trying to do things differently than the way we were raised, right? I mean, I think it's whether we've just implicitly understood this without actually fully understanding it, or whether we've explicitly thought this through. I think many of us can look back at the way we were raised and think, well, yeah, my parents were doing the best they could with the tools and the skills and the resources they had. And the way I was raised left me with some pretty deep scars. And I want to try to raise my kids in a way that perhaps doesn't, right, create a childhood that they end up having to recover from for the rest of their lives. You know, a lot of the parents that I work with are carrying around an enormous amount of shame and hurt, and they don't know where it comes from. And so what we're trying to do is to shift the way that we interact with our children so that we aren't shaming them, so that they aren't carrying around all of this hurt. And, you know, the idea of respectful parenting, gentle parenting, it kind of tends to iterate in terminology. And there aren't really any great definitions of what these things are. I think there's just sort of a general sense that when we were being raised, you know, respect meant you're going to respect me because I'm bigger than you are and I can make you do what I say. And we kind of look back at that and being like, yeah, that doesn't feel very good. It didn't feel good to me at the time. And it doesn't feel good when I do it to my child. And so I sort of think of this sort of respectful, gentle parenting world as parenting that sees the child's needs as equally important as the parent's needs. And that's not the same way that everybody sees it, right? There are definitely people within this space who see it as a bit more of a top down, right? You're going to be the family leader. You're going to be the one who ultimately makes all the decisions. And I'm not saying that we devolve all decision making to the children. I'm also not saying, which I think a lot of gentle parenting, it sort of goes down this slippery slope of positioning the mother, and it's, you know, it's always the mother, is the person whose job it is to create this optimal environment for the child. And she basically sacrifices herself at the altar of, right, making everything perfect for the child. And in my mind, that just perpetuates patriarchy, right? That just perpetuates the mother not having any needs of her own, not knowing what they are, not being able to articulate them, never getting them met, and the child's needs come first. And so I'm not really interested in that either. What I'm interested it in is, hey, I'm your parent. I am a whole person. I have needs. And you, my child, you are a whole person who has needs. And I'm going to hold your needs with just as much love and care and attention as I hold my needs. And that maybe 90% of the time, we can find a way to meet both of our needs. And when we can do that, we're going to do that. And then on the relatively few occasions when we can't, we're going to use other tools, right? We're going to set things like boundaries as our first resort tool. We're going to set a limit, which is, you know, a boundary is when I say, I'm not willing to do something. I'm not willing to get the green spoon for you until I finish my dinner. You can go and get the green spoon if you want the green spoon. I'm not willing to get up. Whereas a limit is, I'm trying to change your behavior. You may not get the green spoon. You may not jump on the couch, right? We're setting boundaries first and then setting limits. As a sort of last resort. And then we're just in an entirely different kind of relationship with our children, where we're just, you know, the old paradigm of, am I too strict? Am I too permissive? Just becomes irrelevant because we're just two people getting our needs met in this relationship.
Well, that is so beautifully articulated. I don't think I've ever heard a definition that's just so clear, because it is about meeting the needs of the parent and the child. It's actually quite simple when you boil it down in that way.
It sounds very simple, yes. And so why is it so hard, right? Because our parents told us that you shouldn't have needs. You are too loud. You're too big. You're too much. The world is going to reject you if you make your needs known. And so I, as your loving parent who wants nothing but the best for you, I'm going to train you to shut that down. And maybe also I'm having a really hard time coping because I'm parenting with all of my own unresolved trauma as well. And so it's easier for me if you just stop asking, right? If you just stop telling me that you have needs. And so, of course, we get to midlife and we're like, oh, I have needs, right? I work with parents who they start working with me and they're like, until I met you, I had no idea I even had needs. Never mind what they were. Never mind how to articulate them and actually get them back.
How wild is that? And I mean, of course, how can you parent? I mean, being a parent is just showing up in right relationship with your child, you know, in so many ways. And how can you have that depth of relationship if you don't even know what your own needs are? I think this is why we're in this messy middle moment of like wanting to be different from how we were parented, but doing it without a lot of the tools that are necessary. So we're doing a lot of work, our generation of parents, right?
Yes. And that's really hard, right? It's really hard when you know, like you're like, I know I don't want to do that because that really hurt me, but I don't know what to do. So I'm trying to figure this out by myself in the moment when things are really hard, instead of having a set of tools, which is what Parenting Beyond Power provides, right? It's this framework for how do we approach these situations that seem really difficult, where my child is resisting, they're stalling, they're having a tantrum, they're using, you know, they're using a tone of voice that I perceive to be disrespectful, right? They're doing all these things that I find difficult. Well, we're not approaching those on a, okay, what do I do about this and that? And that. We're seeing underneath all of that is a child who has needs that are not being met right now. And that's why you're seeing this resistance. And if, by the way, you parent are feeling frustration and anger and resentment, chances are you have unmet needs too. And so let's try and figure out what your needs are and get those met more often. And also let's figure out what your child's needs are and get those met more often. And then everybody feels good, right? You're not in this constantly, you know, battle relationship with your child.
Well, let's get into the book then, because you mentioned about Parenting Beyond Power giving those tools. But we might start with the premise of the book, which is meaty, right? And it is that there are social forces that are core components of our culture that we all recognize, and you name them.
Well, some of us recognize, I would interrupt.
Correct. Good spot that some of us recognize. Patriarchy, capitalism, and white supremacy. And it examines how these systems shape our culture, and therefore they're going to shape our family life. Because if they shape our culture, they shape people, they shape how we view the world, our expectations, what we might want for what kind of world we want for our children, what success looks like, what good looks like, And here in Ireland, because we're a slightly different cultural context than the United States, maybe white supremacy is still absolutely a factor here. But I think maybe colonialism, imperialism, those kind of things might ring true for people as well, especially because we are a post-colonial country and live with many, many hang-ups as a result of that. And we feel that very deeply, I think, still. You know, there was an 800-year war that has only really resolved in inverted commas in the 70s and is still ongoing. And, you know, as in there's still a conflict there that is not resolved. How do these big, massive, giant, hairy social forces impact on this micro like unit of society, the family?
I guess, you know, firstly, just sort of on the Irish context, I'm English and it is, I mean, it's wild how little of this I learned in school. And I hiked the Dingle Way with my daughter. So that's for those listeners who are not in Ireland, it's a peninsula on the West Coast and there's a trail around it. I want to say is it 60 miles or something like that?
Okay. I haven't actually hiked it. I've been on part of it, but it is beautiful.
Okay. Yeah. So it's an awesome hiking trail. My daughter was like 9 months old. I had her in a backpack. We're hiking from one B&B to the next. It was fantastic. And there's a point on that hike where you can go to what's called the Sleahead Famine Cottages. And it's a place where there were people who lived there during what I had grown up calling the potato famine. And they had six kids who died like right after childbirth. And the local church said, well, they weren't baptized. They can't be buried in the church. And so there's these little, you know, grave area where these six infants were buried. And there was an interpretive sign right outside there that said, we don't call it the potato famine, right? We call it the great hunger, because it's not that there was no food in Ireland at the time. There was plenty of food being grown. It was all being shipped to England to pay rent. Because the English owned all the land. And I was like, how is it possible that I didn't know this, right? That schools in England don't think that this is an appropriate thing to teach, that we're just kind of sweep it under the rug and pretend that it didn't happen.
Well, we were taught that in school as well, Jen, like in primary school, that was what I was taught. It was a potato famine. All the potatoes got the blight and everyone was very poor. I only learned that analysis when I was an adult and I live here.
Right. Yes. Okay. So that's even wilder, right? That this is the, you know, where you're actually living. I'm on the, you know, the side of the colonizers. And so we can kind of see that there's a reason why the English would want to think of themselves as, you know, as good people. And so we wouldn't tell the whole story. And then of course it shows up in other ways as the Irish start emigrating to the US and they weren't considered white when they first arrived in the US.
Yeah. Wild, isn't it?
And they actually kind of classified themselves as whiter than the newly emancipated African-Americans who, you know, the Irish are like, well, they're coming up and stealing our jobs now that they're not enslaved anymore. And so we can position ourselves as whiter than them to, you know, because then we have more proximity to jobs and that kind of thing. So so this stuff impacts, has such a long history in us and it's still showing up with us today. And so, you know, what are some of the ways that this, that we see this, right? And so, well, let's take the three social forces you mentioned one by one. So patriarchy, right? The idea that there is a position of power in a family, in a society, and that is usually going to be held by a man. And I was in Vancouver a few months ago and sitting outside a store, my husband was running an errand in the store. Karis and I were outside with the windows down. And there's a car park next to us and there's a family, two parents and a kid, and the mom's trying to get the kid into the car seat. And the mom says, you better get in the car seat before daddy gets really angry. Mm. Right. She's calling on the patriarchal system of domination where daddy's at the top and daddy says what's going to happen. And she's using that to get her kid to do what she wants him to do without understanding why does he not want to get in the car seat. Right. which is what the framework in Parenting Beyond Power says is, you know, why does he not want to get in the car seat? Can we address that issue? Is there something really interesting that he wants to spend a couple minutes exploring? Is he uncomfortable in the car seat? And that's the sort of power with approach rather than the power over, you know, I'm going to use daddy's authority to get you to do what I want you to do. You mentioned white supremacy as well, which is not about you know, am I nice to people whose skin color is different from mine? This is another system of domination. And a number of years ago, an anti-racist educator named Timur Akun did some work to see how white supremacy shows up in companies. And then more recently, another anti-racist educator named Amanda Gross translated that into families, right? And so what are some of the ways that we see this? Well, things like, you know, binary either or thinking. So you're with me or you're against me. You think like I do or you don't. Perfectionism, fear of open conflict, individualism. And I do workshops on this topic, and I ask parents, you know, what kind of things were you rewarded for doing? What kind of things were you punished and shamed for doing when you were a kid? And then we walk through, right, all of these different characteristics, and they're like, yeah, that one and that one and that one and that one. And so we start to see how these characteristics are ones that are that we are rewarded for fitting in with, and that we are punished and shamed for moving away from, right? And that happened in our families, like every single day, these subtle rewards, these subtle punishments, and even the not so subtle ones as well. So that touched on patriarchy, white supremacy. I want to pause there and just see, you know, if anything's coming up for you, and we can talk about capitalism as well, if you'd like.
Yeah, I mean, like I really enjoy like reading a lot of anti-racist work, and it always brings me back to Indigenous thinking, you know, and a lot of the Indigenous thinking from this part of the world is rooted in our language, in the Irish language that we've lost. And, you know, there's a great guy called Mancan McGann who is doing a lot of work to revive the Irish language. But he wrote a book called 42 Words for Field, because there are 42 words for field in the Irish language. The English language has one word, which is field. And it's like there is a word for a boggy field that smells fresh on a morning after it's been raining. There is like all this diversity and richness in language, because categories were just not really there was so much more room for nuance. You know, it wasn't about fitting into a box. It wasn't about performing a function, which is kind of going from white supremacy into capitalism also. It was much more rich than that. And I think we had a much richer understanding of the true meaning of diversity, and that we valued the marginal, and we valued what was, I suppose, made us unique and different and brilliant. Whereas I think, you know, a lot of the thinking that comes out of white supremacy is the black and white, the lack of being able to see subtleties and nuances and patterns. And
100% agree. I'm less familiar with the Irish context and more familiar with the American context, just because I've been here for more than 20 years now. And yeah, exactly the same thing happening here. And to compound it, right, we spent hundreds of years committing genocide and I'm telling Indigenous parents that you're terrible parents and we're going to separate your family. We're going to break your traditions. We're going to try, right? Many of them have been able to continue those to some extent. And you are not going to be able to raise your children because our way of raising children is better. And then, right, we get to this point, we're like, oh, actually the way we have been raising children has created all kinds of mental illness and challenges and, you know, things that we now recognize, well, shoot, that didn't go very well. And, oh, is it possible that the Indigenous people actually, the way that they were doing it was better? I mean, the irony of ironies, right? That we spend centuries telling a group of people that you can't parent the way you're parenting because that's not the right way to parent. And then the way that we have been parenting has created so many challenges for so many people. It's shocking and it's shameful, and yet here we are today.
And let's finish then in terms of capitalism. Well, finish out that loop of a thought. How does capitalism impact our parenting?
Yeah. And this one I think can be a harder thing to see, but it's definitely still there, right? So for example, when a child has an interest in something, we tend to value it more if it's something they could make a business out of. Right? Oh, you're interested in, I don't know, knitting or cooking, or, oh yeah, you could have a lemonade stand, or you could sell your stuff on Etsy or whatever. And if it's not something that's monetizable, then we kind of put less value on it. I work with a lot of parents who were really opinionated as children, and the kind of things their parents would say to them is, oh yeah, you'll be a great lawyer one day, right? your desire to be heard, you're trying to get your needs met, is something that you'll be able to monetize in the future. Right now, just stop doing it right now because it's too hard for me to deal with. But when it's monetizable, then it will have value. So it links also to white supremacy, right? The idea of individualism and all, every decision that we make is an individual decision, things like crime, right? And so if I commit a crime, then that was my bad choice and I deserve to be punished for that, rather than seeing these systemic issues of power, right? So children might play, you know, going to jail, bad people go to jail. And well, when my daughter went through a phase of exploring that, we had a lot of conversations about, well, sometimes people who end up in jail end up there because maybe they made decisions that actually don't align with our values and even with their own values, but it seemed like the best decision that was available to them at the time. And maybe they ended up in jail because they couldn't afford a lawyer because there's all these other systemic issues happening. And the white guy who did something way worse and stole way more money from way more people could afford an expensive lawyer and managed to stay out of jail, right? And so all of these systemic issues show up every day in just, you know, the games our children play and the things that we value. And again, the kinds of things we reward them for doing, right? We shower attention on things that could become a business. And we are like, okay, whatever, to things that don't have that monetary value assigned to them.
And I think it's just in the games that kids play about what they want to buy and what, you know, like my kids talk about being rich, you know, are we middling rich? Are we really rich? And like they really want to know, like they want to pin that down and how rich are other people? And my son is nearly seven, but he was saying to me the other day, do we live in a luxury house or is it a premium house? I was like, where are you getting these words from? Like, what does this mean? But it's really interesting how they start thinking about commodities and value, you know, in that way. It's so young. And then like all the kids in Ireland wear uniforms to school if they're in mainstream schools. And one of the reasons why, you know, when parents kind of give out or whatever and say, we need to like let kids be just individuals and let them wear what they want. And one of the main reasons that everybody comes back with is, oh, well, what about the child who can't afford the best runners and it will become a fashion show and it will become, you know, this big parade of labels and everything, you know? And I find that such a difficult argument to hear because I'm like, it doesn't have to be like that. Like that's a capitalism problem. That's not a kids wearing what they want to wear problem. Like,
yeah. And yeah. Oh gosh. I was the kid whose family couldn't afford the clothes. And I remember in my teenage years, actually one day I taped the word Nike to my running shoes. Cause I was so sick of being teased for, you know, having the wrong running shoes for PE class. So I think there is a real fear there, but I also think, you know, if the only way that we're addressing that is by allowing children to wear or not wear whatever clothes, we're kind of missing the boat, right?
Right.
You know, my daughter's in a, we call it a not school program, right? She goes to a sort of unschooling program once a week. And I mean, she wears half her clothes inside out and to front. And the kids just don't care, right? They don't pay attention. They don't care. And I think that is in large part, and this sort of starts to get to the real core of the ideas in the book, is that I think when kids don't have power, when they know they don't have power, which within a school system, they really don't, they have no autonomy, right? They can't make decisions about anything that's really important. They might get to pick between two different things that the teacher's already decided is okay. But other than that, every single thing about how they move through their day, whether they can use the bathroom, whether they can eat, all of those kinds of things are decided for them. And if all that's decided for them, then one of the things that they have some autonomy over is what do I wear, right? And so even within a school uniform, in my school, you could always tell who were the rich kids and who were the poor kids, right? The rich kids had the pants with the turnips on the bottom and the poor kids were the ones who didn't have the turnips and his pants just went straight down. Trousers, sorry. So you can still tell. And where children have real autonomy, where they can actually make real decisions and know that an adult is going to consider their ideas with equal weight as their own, all of a sudden, all of the little stuff where they try and exert that control and independence, it just becomes irrelevant, right? They don't do that anymore because they're actually making decisions about things that really are important to them.
I'm just going to talk about then these power structures and, you know, how we use power in parenting. Okay. So I think that that's something that I've really struggled with as a parent from day one, is like, how do I, as a feminist and like, you know, as somebody who's very conscious of power in my life and day to day, how do I use power? What kind of models of power? And I was been very influenced by Starhawk, who's an amazing feminist woman who writes a lot about power. And she talks about three types of power: power over, which is domination, control. You can, you can't. I'm in charge. You're, you know, the underling. Power from within, which is our own personal agency, our abilities. And then power with, which is when you share social power among equals. And I've always struggled with that idea of like, how do I get, like, I want to be able to treat my child in that power with way. But sometimes there's times when, say, my child is being aggressive towards another child, or they're not sharing, or they're being deliberately unkind. I feel like I need to put a foot down, right? And like assert, like you were talking about boundaries and limits, assert those limits. But the child is not necessarily consenting to that in the moment, because right, they're going, right? So like that, I find that balance really difficult. So in your book, can you talk to us about like, how then do we interact with power with our children in a way that's more egalitarian?
Yeah. Yeah. So now, I mean, let's make it super concrete, right? Do you have an example of a time when this has happened recently?
Yeah. I mean, like, this is a very simple, common example, but we carpool to, my kid goes to a part-time school 3 days a week, and we carpool with a couple of other parents, and there's kids fighting in the back, and there's name calling. And my child is saying a very mean name to the child who's in the back, and the child who's in the back is getting upset. And I'm saying, we don't talk to each other like that. We don't use names like that in this car. The end. I do not want to hear that again. Being very strong in my words. And then it's continuing to happen. And then like the other day, I ended up pulling over to the side of the road and opening the door and being like, guys, I do not want to hear that kind of, I don't want to hear this name calling, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. And so, right, a couple of different threads to follow on this, right?
Yeah.
So firstly, you know, what's coming up for you in this kind of interaction? And I'm wondering about things like, you know, what were your relationships like with your friends when you were your kid's age, right? What was social life like for you at that stage of your life?
That's interesting, because I would probably been on the receiving end of name calling, but I was a very, quite a meek child. So yeah, I'm always like, big value in our house is fairness and kindness and, you know, like being nice to other people, no matter who they are, even if you don't particularly like them, you have to be nice to people. So yeah, I think probably I was maybe standing up for that other kid in that moment, because maybe I saw myself in them. Yeah.
Yeah. You saw yourself in the kid that might be feeling hurt by being on the receiving end of it, right? When this kid is not you, right? We have to really separate that. And very, very often parents identify with their own kid in this. And we don't want our children to struggle in the same way that we have struggled. So whenever it looks like our children are having a hard time, we want to fix it so that they don't struggle in the same way that we have struggled. And I see this come up. It's kind of interesting how it comes up in sibling fighting. And it's almost like it doesn't matter which way the parents' relationship with their own siblings went, right? They might have had a terrible relationship with their siblings, and they see their kids fighting, and they're like, oh my goodness, they're going to have an awful relationship with each other, just like I do with my siblings. And then if it goes the other way and the parent had a great relationship with their siblings, they look at their own kids fighting and they're like, oh my goodness, they're never going to have the amazing relationship that I have. They have to stop fighting right now. And so I think it's really important that we see that identification happening, and that we kind of try and separate that, right? Because the reason, I mean, I'm guessing that you're feeling, you know, if not flooded, which is, you know, kind of overwhelmed, maybe triggered, which is when it links to a previous trauma, right? It's possible that if you were on the receiving end of this repeatedly for a long period of time, and you didn't have a trusted adult who could help you to process that, that may have been a traumatic experience for you. And so when you hear another child on the receiving end of that, you're right back there again, right? You are flooded or triggered. And of course, you don't want to hear that. Of course, it's hard for you to hear. And that is your thing to own. Right? That is your work to do. That is your healing to do, rather than putting that on them. So let me just pause there and see what's coming up as I There's no brain.
I mean, I totally identify with that. That's why probably I was coming from my more reptilian brain in that moment. But I do wonder about how then to have a conversation that would have been more productive while still, I mean, essentially, I did still want to end the behavior. Like, I don't want my son going out and calling other kids names, because I just think that's not the kind of family that I want us to live in, where we're calling people names. I suppose I'm thinking about, you know, leadership a lot when I think of parenting. And, you know, something that I referred to before we spoke was Paulo Freire's work, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which is a manifesto I read a long time ago about education and social change. And when he's talking about educators, I feel like it could really, you know, also be the equivalent for parents. And he talks about leaders not manipulating people and not, like, you know, imposing decisions on people, but like how, because they're not leaders, they're oppressors. What then is a leader, or how do you? So I guess I want to always model good behavior, but in that moment, how could I have handled that in a way that was more power with than power over?
Yeah. I think in some way this takes us back to the school uniform conversation, right? Because it's definitely possible that within, I mean, you're on your way to school as this is happening, right? You're on your way to an environment where everything that kids say and do is very tightly controlled. And so in a way, it's possible they're using this time as a way of asserting their independence, their autonomy, their right to say whatever they want, right? And so I wouldn't start by addressing it in that moment. That's one of the key ideas in parenting beyond power, is if you're addressing it in the moment, we already know you're at least flooded, if not triggered. That is not the moment when you want to be having a conversation with your child about something that's really important to you. So we're going to kind of try and get as gracefully as we can through that immediate situation. And then later on, ask our child, hey, can we talk about what happened in the car earlier? Would that be okay? Because that felt really uncomfortable to me. And I'm wondering what was coming up for you, right? So right at the beginning, we're asking for their consent to participate in the conversation. We're not assuming that we have the power to get them to talk to us. And we could maybe share a little bit about how we felt uncomfortable hearing those words used. And obviously, I don't know what the words were, but I'm assuming they're pretty bad. And then maybe we can hear from them, you know, what was going on for them. Maybe for them, it was entirely playful. Maybe they didn't perceive it as an awful insult. Maybe they could well have been practicing the same system of domination that they are about to go into in school, right? And that we're trying so hard not to do in our family. But if you're telling them, stop doing that, you are using your power over them to get them to stop, right? Even though that goes against your value, you are operating within a system of domination. And so it's possible that you can't actually make them stop, right? You can't. You are not physically capable of stopping these words coming out of their mouths. And they know that.
God, that is that's just very profound for me right now, because I don't think I've ever thought you cannot stop that. Like, as you were saying, wait till later, in my mind, I was like, but then it's just still happening in the moment and I could do something to stop it. And you're right. Unless I physically restrain them. I mean, how am I going to stop them?
Unless you are going to sit there and hold their lips while you're driving with the other hand.
Then you are using power.
You are still using power. Yeah. And so you don't have to wait for this to happen again. You could do this tonight if you want to, right? When your kid gets home from school and say, hey, can we talk about what happened the other morning? Would that be okay? And share how you're feeling. And then what you're looking to understand ultimately is, what needs did they have in that moment? What needs did you have, right? What I heard from you is you had a need for emotional safety. You had a need for calm and ease probably, and kind of the mental space to be able to drive the car safely. So all of those things were coming up for you. And what was coming up for your child, right? Were they actually exploring power and how to have power over somebody? Is that what they were doing in this very small few minutes where they actually get to be able to do that? Were they playing? Were they having fun with each other? When we understand why they were doing that, then we can actually talk with them about, okay, so what do we believe in our family? And I do think there's a real danger when we talk about family values, that even can exist within a system of domination. Because when the parents decide what the values are and then say to the kid, well, we have a value of kindness in our family, and so you can't say that word to your friend. I mean, what are we doing?
You're blowing my mind here, Jen.
So if the kid hasn't had any kind of input in what are our family values, then it's just perpetuating the same stuff. So I think, again, we can kind of pull this back and say, is this really important to you? Do you believe in this family value of kindness? Should this be our family value? If it should, what does that say about how we interact with our friends? Are there situations in which actually it is appropriate to use that language with each other in an isolated place where nobody else can hear and the other person is consenting, right? Is it actually appropriate? And maybe the two of you decide together, actually, in that particular environment, it is appropriate. And you can see, okay, yes, I can see how they're meeting this need. And I can see, actually, I can meet my need for emotional safety. And I can tune them out for a few minutes and concentrate on driving. And I can get my needs met at the same time, right? And so this does not require our child to stop using this word necessarily. Or we may decide together, you know what, we actually do have this value of kindness. And people who treat each other kindly tend not to use this word. Do you think we should keep using this word? And if the child has a genuine input into the quote-unquote rulemaking, decision-making, chances are they're going to go along with it, right? And then in the car, the conversation you're having is, hey, remember we had that conversation and we decided that we have together, we believe we have this value, family value of kindness, and that we decided we didn't want to use that word and we came up with some other words that we can use instead. Do you want to use one of those other words right now? And then that's such a different conversation from stop doing it because I'm triggered and flooded and because I told you to. Mm-hmm.
And something that I was just reflecting on when you were talking about the unmet need of the child, when you're trying to put them in the car seat, for example, you know, I think babies are really good at telling us what their needs are right when they're born. It's just like, you know, they're very clear. I need a change. I'm hungry. I'm overtired. I'm teething. And like, they can't talk to us, but they can tell us what their needs are. And their needs are simple. It's almost like training wheels for being a parent in the later years, because as they get older, the needs get more and more complicated and it becomes quite tricky to figure out. And I even find sometimes, you know, I have a 4-year-old and an almost 7-year-old, and my 4-year-old, I'm like, he's overtired, he's overdone it, maybe he's overstimulated, maybe this and that, or maybe he went to kindergarten, he was complaining about a boy he had a fight with, whatever. You know, it can be quite simple to read him. And now that my other little boy is turning 7, I'm like, oh my God, he's getting real hard to read. And like, his needs are becoming more complex, but he doesn't quite have the language yet to articulate what his needs are. So how do we tell what our child's needs are, and or how could we spot an unmet need?
Right. Yeah. Oh gosh. One of my favorite questions. Because there are so many ways to do it, right? And I think there's a common phrase in the sort of respectful, gentle parenting world of all behavior is communication. 100% agree. And also it kind of leaves us hanging, because all behavior is communication of what? What is my child trying to tell me when they hit me, when they, you know, run away from me, when I'm trying to put their shoes on, when they do these mystifying things? So one of our best tools that we have is to look for patterns. When is this stuff coming up, right? And so if the child is resisting getting the car seat, and this could be a pre-verbal, non-verbal child, right? If they're resisting getting in the car seat only on days when they're going to preschool or school or wherever the thing is, we could imagine that maybe the problem is not the car seat. Maybe the problem is what's happening at the destination. And that perhaps we can have a talk with the teacher about, you know, are they having some kind of problem in the classroom, or are they not wanting to do drop off, right? Because they're so attached to us and they would rather be with us and they don't want that moment to come. And so they're prolonging getting in the car seat so they can be with us for longer. Or is it happening even when we're going to the park where they really want to go. They still don't want to get in the car seat. Then we could imagine maybe this is something about the car seat rather than about the place that we're going. So I think that the keeping track of when do these kinds of things come up can be really helpful, right? I mean, and you're probably laughing like, yeah, autistic pattern recognition happening right here.
That's exactly what I was thinking. So well detected.
it's a very useful skill to have, but it's a skill that anyone can do, right? You can look back and see when am I seeing resistance and struggle from my child, which is an indication of an unmet need. If it's still difficult, I actually have a quiz on my website, yourparentingmojo.com/quiz. And it's 10 super short, easy questions. And once I have the answers to those questions, I can tell you what is likely to be one of your child's biggest needs. And also some ways that you can go ahead and help them to meet that need. And I think an important thing to see is that we don't always have to address this in the moment, right? Sometimes a child will resist. I mean, I'm thinking of an example from the book where the parent is saying to the child every day, get dressed, no, get dressed, no. And we start working together. And I said, did you ever ask her why she doesn't want to get dressed? No, I hadn't thought of that. Well, why don't you ask her, child, why don't you want to get dressed? Because I like knowing that you are the last person to touch my clothes in the morning before I them on and leave the house, right? Need for connection.
Oh.
Is the parent willing to help the child meet that need? Of course.
Of course. Wow.
Of course. Parent hugs the clothes. The child puts the clothes on. There's no more fight, right? Because everybody's having their needs met. Child's need for connection, parent's needs for ease and harmony and all that stuff in the mornings. That's an example of a time when you can meet the need in the moment. Sometimes our children have needs for things like autonomy and we are struggling to get out the door. We still want to get out the door, right? We're not giving them autonomy over, are we leaving the house today? But when we are making decisions throughout the day, about every aspect of their life, then they may have a need for autonomy that is not being met. I teach a free workshop called Setting Loving and Effective Limits. And the first thing I ask people to do is to make a list of how many limits they're setting. I mean, I've yet to meet a parent who's not stunned by the results.
Wow.
I mean, the Gottmans, right? Dr. John and Julie Gottman talk about how you need 5 positive interactions for every negative interaction in a relationship to feel good about the relationship. And every limit that we set on our child's behavior is a mark in the negative interaction column. And so many of us are far from that 5-to-1 ratio. Many of us have flipped that ratio on its head. And we're setting 5 limits, 5 restrictions on our child's behavior, 5 instructions telling them what to do for every 1 positive interaction. And so, of course, the child resists anytime they can, right? There's an issue that they know is important to you, like getting out of the house on time. They're like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not putting my shoes on because I can resist that. And when we see that need for autonomy, if it is a need for autonomy and not connection, right, in this particular case, and we give them much more say over as much as we possibly can about things that are happening in their life, then we find they come towards us in those difficult moments and they stop resisting in those difficult moments. And I've seen it happen so many times.
Beautiful. Well, I wanted to end, Jen, with a thought experiment, if that's okay. So one of my favorite thinkers, writers, people in general, is a man called Rob Hopkins, and he has a podcast called What If to What Next. I don't know if you've ever listened to it, but if you haven't, I think you'd enjoy it, where he sits down with interesting, creative thinkers and they take on a problem and they ask, what if this changed? And so I'm going to borrow from him and say, if we could fast forward to a world that where we live beyond and outside capitalism, patriarchy, colonialism, white supremacy. Imagine we've gone on a journey of growth and we're arriving into 2034, 10 years in the future, a decade of the most incredible social change imaginable has occurred. Everything that could have been done to end these systems of oppression has been done. So arriving into this society, what kind of families would we see?
I mean, I guess, first of all, I would say, wow, your optimism is amazing.
It's a thought experiment.
Yes. And I mean, the timeline itself is
decades. I think that should be enough time. I think if we all work together tirelessly for a decade and everyone was pointed in the right direction, it's doable.
Right. And that's the thing, right? Everybody working together pointed in the quote unquote right direction. I mean, 50% of people in the US think that white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism are kind of the natural order of things, and we want more of those things. So the chances of us getting everybody working in the quote unquote right direction in a decade is, I think, you know, generously optimistic, but I'm going to roll with it, right?
Play the game.
I'll play the game. So firstly, I think it's going to take much longer than that, right? And I think of the quote, I'm planting trees under whose shade I do not expect to sit. And frankly, I don't think my daughter's going to sit under those trees either. I think this is going to take a lot longer. And I really hope that we get there. And I hope that my work is part of the much broader work of folks who are working on this that helps us to move in a direction. I also don't have all the answers, right? I don't know if we're not reliant on capitalism, what replaces capitalism? Mm-hmm. The obvious answer is communism. Well, that has a lot of problems too, right? But I can imagine that people who think a lot about those things could imagine systems that could replace capitalism. And so I'm kind of, you know, taking that as a given that something else will come that doesn't have all of the problems that communism has as well. And I think, you know, the overarching principle that I see is that white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism are all systems of domination, right? We've talked about how that shows up in the micro level of the family, and also how they are systems of domination in the macro level of society as well. And so this world that we are moving towards is a world where your needs are just as important as my needs. Because we can't have these systems of domination where our needs are equally valid, right? In white supremacy, my needs are more important because I'm white. In patriarchy, a man's needs are more important than a woman's. In capitalism, a person with money's needs are more important than a person who doesn't have money. And so when we say that everybody's needs are equally important, we are almost inherently saying, okay, those systems don't work anymore. So we have to get rid of capitalism, right? Or it's operating on a much reduced form. And if we still have it, then, you know, everybody's getting some kind of universal basic income and healthcare. So nobody has to worry about their essential needs. And everybody has the freedom to be creative because they're not, you know, terrified that they're going to lose their house or their health insurance or, you know, whatever it is that we decide collectively is the basic essential needs. We also have to assume we've fixed climate change, which is kind of a big thing by itself, but that has to be part of it. We perceive that the work of caring for others, that the work of being in relationship with others is as important, if not even more important, than work that generates income, if there is some still sort of, you know, minimized capitalism going on. And we will know that is happening because men will want to do it. It won't be devalued because women, because people of color are the only ones who will take those jobs. It will be valued, and we will know that because white men will consider care work as a quote unquote career as much as they consider well-paying jobs. We won't be having white women outsourcing care to black and brown women so white women can get ahead within the capitalist system. We won't have these chains of care where people in countries like the Philippines will leave their kids with grandparents so that they can go and take care of a white person's kids in another country. So we're dismantling all of those systems. And what we're doing is we're having relationships that allow us to take care of most of our needs instead of paying for them. We have things like retirement, right? Pension, social security, because we don't have the relationships that we need that mean that somebody would take care of us when we get old. And so we have to have money so that we can know that we will be able to pay somebody to take care of us, because we don't have that social contract that says, you know, I'm taking care of you now, and I hope that you're going to take care of me when I need taking care of as well. So I don't want to kind of imagine this, you know, this utopia where we just don't see color anymore. We just don't see the color of everybody's skin, because that to me doesn't help. We know that race is a meaningless idea that we just made up. And also we can celebrate each person's and each culture's contributions to the whole. And all of that I hope, contributes to this society where each person gets to be their whole self. Because all of us today in our non-utopian culture are constantly sending out this message to the world. Am I lovable? Am I lovable just the way I am? And what we want to hear back is the message, yes, you are lovable. And right now our culture says, no, you're really not. You're too big, too loud, too much. Stuff it down. Stop making your needs met. And in my utopian world, that message always comes back. Yes, just the way you are, just the color of the skin that you have, just your neurodivergence, just all of the other stuff that makes you uniquely you. You are lovable. You contribute to the world in the way that we need. And that's the kind of world that I want to live in, that I want my daughter to live in, that I hope that we are working to create together.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, look, I do think that change is possible, maybe not in a decade of dismantling systems of power that have been in place for so many years and that many people, as you say, think are the natural order of things. But I do think that change on a micro level can create change on a macro level as well.
Yes. And that's why I'm doing this, right?
Correct. And the founder of our charity, Niall Breslin, was just doing a talk the other day and he was saying that we're in a wet lava moment at the moment. You know, socially things are moving and shifting and changing, and it's an opportunity for us to really start pushing, changing how we see things before the lava sets again. And, you know, I think your work is really important because it's bringing together so many intersections of different ideas and looking at our lives as parents through that lens. And I think it's really critical for us to ask these hard questions of ourselves, you know, as people. And majority of people listening to this will say that they want to parent differently. And parenting differently means parenting with a different ideological framework. I feel like for me personally, having your hand at my back across the Atlantic Ocean as a parent has been really valuable for me personally as a parent, to be able to hold that in my mind, that this isn't just an individual interaction. This is something that's part of, you know, we're raising children to be different in the world. And it's a big job.
It is, yeah. Because what they learn from us, what they practice with us, they take out, right? The parents that I work with report, yeah, we do this at home. And oh, now I see my kid, when they see another kid being bullied at school, they go and make friends with that kid, right? They are the peacemaker on the playground, because all the other kids know, oh yeah, this kid is going to be able to help us understand what our needs are and find a way that we can meet everybody's needs. Right. It seems like such a small, what could I possibly do about these massive social issues? This is a real thing. This is not the only thing, right? We also need much bigger systems. We need political change, all those kinds of things. But this is a real thing that makes a real difference in the way that we interact with others in the world, and that our children will as well.
Well, Jen, I can't recommend your book and your podcast highly enough. Everything will be in the show notes for people who want to find out more from you. And I'm sure people will end this podcast wanting to listen to more and being hungry for more. So thank you so much for everything that you do. And thank you for coming on to talk to me today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much, Kira. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you to all our listeners for joining us for this parenting podcast at A Lust for Life. We are committed to providing free, valuable resources and support to children and young people and families like yours, but we can't do it alone. If you found our podcast helpful and informative, please consider supporting our work by making a donation. To donate or learn more about our schools, programs or campaigns, visit alustforlife.ie. Every donation, no matter how small, helps us reach more children with our early intervention programs in schools. Join us on the journey to change the face of mental health in Ireland. Thanks for listening.